Okay, so I'm recording, so this is Bio 241. This is the Tuesday-Thursday section, and it's January 13th. And we're going to go over the introduction to the class. Okay, I asked publication to make copies of the syllabus and the first lecture notes for you, but they haven't come in yet. And maybe they're in my mailbox right now, I'm not sure. All right, so I don't have copies to give you. But I did send you out an email not too long ago showing you how to get to Blackboard and how you could download those materials for yourself. And so I would expect any time after today for you to just go and help yourself and download those materials. All right, now this is not an online class. It's not a hybrid class. So you're not expected to have internet access or a computer or a printer or anything like that. So if you can't get to these materials by yourself online, let me know and I'll provide them for you. Okay, somehow I'll get hard copies for you, but you should be able to access them anytime you want, okay, including the syllabus right here. So let's just talk about the syllabus right now. All right, so here's my phone number, and guess what? I'm hardly ever in my office, but that's okay because there's voicemail. So if you have a question for me, you're studying at 3:30 in the morning, and you want to ask me a question, that's a great time to call that number and ask me, because I'm not going to be in my office at 9 o'clock anyway, right? I'm usually in class. So just download a message to my voicemail, and I'll get back to you. Or you can email me at this location right here. All right. And if you want to come see me during office hours, these might change a little bit because I like to hold open labs in anatomy sometimes, so I won't be in my office. But my office is like the number of days in a year that you see right here. Except what? Except I'm on the second floor instead of the third floor of the building. So it's 265 instead of 365. Okay? Okay, here's your textbook, and you can see that we changed editions for this semester. Sorry about that. I was a little irritated that that happened. New editions are usually better than previous editions, but we had really short notice that that was going to happen. And, of course, the new edition probably is more expensive and all that kind of stuff. I haven't transposed the whole class from the last edition to this one right here. So I'll be doing that through the course of the semester. So you might ask me, can I use an older edition? And I would say probably you can, but a lot of times they change the figure numbers and they change the review questions at the end of the chapter. And I always put exam figures from the textbook on the exam. And in the study guide, I tell you what the exam figures are. So the study guides are going to have the exam figures from this edition right here, not from the 10th edition or the 9th edition. So when I tell you, you got to really study figure 1.3, then you got to know what 1.3 is in this edition here, not the one that you might be using. So there could be some confusion. So it's simplest just to buy the newest edition, which is what, the 11th edition right here. You can still get to all the internet resources that I'll provide a link for you for this edition, but you just won't have the correct hard copy and questions at the end of the chapter, and the answers might even be different as well. Okay. All right, so I do recommend the 11th edition. You should get the lab book. That's a green book. Does anybody have the green book laying around on their desktop you could hold up real quick? Okay, that's the lab manual. You'll work some exercise. That's it right there. Right there, right there. That's a good one. Get that from the bookstore. Here's a picture of what the 11th edition of Fox looks like. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's the lab book, lab manual right there. That's a good one. Hopefully that's less than $100. Is that less than $100? All right, good deal. Yeah, nonetheless. All right, so that's why I like to put a lot of material online, because it's relatively inexpensive to put things online. Okay, email address. You should have an email address, because I send emails out to students to give them important information about tests and things of that nature. All right, here are a couple URLs that you might become, you should be aware of. The Blackboard URL right here, and I think you can get the Blackboard from your gateway, which is right here. And we might do some calculating, some basic kinds of calculations, so you would need a basic scientific non-graphing calculator. So find a calculator that does not have a cell phone, internet access, any of that kind of stuff. You know, I don't know what calculators come with these days. So one that is right? Just has add, subtract, multiply, divide, that kind of thing, and numbers, right? We don't need to do anything too fancy in here, okay? And no pictures or things like that. All right, so this class is a 4-hour class, 3 hours for lecture, and 1 hour for lab. And labs, right, you have to meet for 3 hours to get that 1 hour of credit. So that's really a good deal. So you get 3 hours of work in lab, and you only have to pay for 1 credit in class. That's handy. That's the best deal going anywhere. All right, there is a prerequisite for this class, and that is 231 or Bio 210. 210 is just an A&P class. 231 is anatomy. 230 is anatomy. It's structured a little bit differently, but it's just human anatomy. So please don't consider taking this class without it. And as a matter of fact, if I discover for whatever reason that you don't have the prerequisites, then I'll drop you from the class, even if it's in the middle of the semester. Okay? Because from experience, everybody knows, we have plenty of statistics that shows that you have to pass Bio 231 in order to pass 241. And you want to really know what the brutal truth is about how you should do in 231 before you take 241? All the data shows that in order to pass 241, you should get an A or a B. Right? The data shows that if you get a low C in 231, you almost have no chance of getting through 241. Okay? So that's just a little heads up. All right, I don't want to scare anybody, but if you got like a 70% in 231, you really have to apply yourself, all right, as much as you possibly can to pass this class. And of course, we want everybody to pass this class, right? So I'm just giving you a heads up in that regard. And I always recommend for the students that I have in anatomy to take chemistry first before this class. There is really nothing in particular about chemistry that I can point that says that if you learn chemistry, it will make things easier in physiology, but it always turns out that way. There's just something that happens to people's minds when they take chemistry, right, that helps them in physiology. And I can't really explain it any better than that. Okay, I'm not going to read this. Oh, this is sort of interesting. Email etiquette right here. Whenever you send an email, right before you send it, before you get to the body of the communication, there's a subject heading where you can put just a little note about what the email is about. And in that subject heading, I'm going to ask you to put your last name and the course number as well as the CRN number, because I'm teaching maybe 5 different classes, and some of the classes have 6 or 7 sections. So if you just tell me your last name, I might not even know what class you're taking. And if you tell me what class you're taking, it's going to take me a half hour to find out exactly which class in that class you're in. Okay, so please include all that information, and once you do it a couple times, it will be second nature. It'll be easy for you to remember to put all that in there. Okay, and I'll be happy to respond to you. And as a matter of fact, I might have a spam filter that even just kicks you out of the system if you don't have that in there, right? So, and I won't even know that I got an email from you. So put your last name, the course number, and the CRN number, and that will help me out immensely. Attendance, go ahead and read all this stuff right here, but basically it just says you got to come to class, all right? So we've discussed that, I think, enough. Here's a link if you want to read all that in the Cypress catalog, too. Okay, so here's something important, grading. How do you get a grade in this class? Okay, so the lecture is going to count for 75% of your grade, lab for 25%, because there's 3 hours for lecture and 1 hour for lab. So that's how it's broken down, according to points. So in lab, your grade is going to be made pretty much exclusively by quiz points. All right, so you're going to get 1 or 2 quizzes per lab section, all right, per day. And some of the quizzes will be more challenging than others. There'll be probably a quiz at the beginning and then a little easy quiz at the end, just to make sure that people are working with information, and that quiz at the end gives you feedback to see if you are paying attention to the right stuff in lab, right, to help pace you through the class so you know exactly where you stand. And so I don't know how many quizzes there are going to be. There could be maybe 16 quizzes or maybe 30 quizzes. All depends on the lab instructor. Some days you might have 2, some days there might be time only for 1 because you're busy doing lab work. I'm not really sure. All right. But you should stay in lab for the whole lab period until you're excused by your lab instructor, and there'll be a sign out sheet when class is dismissed in lab. Make sure you sign the sign out sheet or the sign in sheet. And I'll have one in here too. Here it is for today. It's real important for today, because if people don't attend class, then I have to drop them. All right. Now, so I made a little roster, and I can see that two students got dropped from the end right here on this first page. Somebody with a last name that starts with an L. Okay. Maybe an M. But everybody else that's on this sheet should be registered, except for I had a computer problem. Didn't print out two people's names on there. So please sign this and pass it to the next person, and then this is your receipt that you were in class. Right? So if I drop you for not attending, you could say, well, let's see the sign-in sheet, and I pull it out, and you've signed it. Well, what does that say? I made a mistake, and I've got to go sign the forms at the dean's office or administration and records to get you back in the class, right? So it's important that you sign this every time, please. Okay. In lecture as well as lab. All right, so attendance is important. You don't get points, but at least you don't get dropped. You're going to have 5 lecture tests, and the lecture tests are going to be worth 100 points each. So 160 points for lab and 500 points for lecture. That means 25% of the classes are the lecture tests and 25% are the lab quizzes. Tests in class will be multiple choice, maybe fill in the blank, maybe some matching with fill in the blank. And then there's another component that I like, and that's a graphical component. I'll photocopy a picture out of your textbook, and I'll have you label it. And it could be a flow diagram, could be a physiologic process, it might include some anatomy, or it might include some molecular structure, or something of that nature. All right, so that's clearly defined in the study guide, and I even include those pictures. Even though you have a picture in your book, I include those pictures as a JPEG in the study guide with the labels erased, and you can practice relabeling those pictures, you know, 10 times or 20 times or how many times you need to relabel them so you get 100%. So that part of the test, you know, if you're a visual learner, is easy. You can get 100%. If you're not a visual learner, then you just have to practice a little more, which means you still can get 100% on that part of the test, right? And that used maybe around 30%. Sometimes I don't, some semesters I don't have essay questions, but that's a possibility. Usually I like to have long answer questions or essay questions covered in lab, but not lecture. All right, so mostly multiple choice, true, false, matching, and that graphical component for the lecture tests. And there are questions at the end of the chapter with answers at the back of the book. Sometimes I take those questions and put them on the test. So if I tell you to study a particular question at the end of a chapter or maybe embedded in the chapter someplace that could be on the test, definitely review it before the test and understand why the correct answer is the correct answer and the others are not correct. So please don't just memorize the question and what answer is correct. Don't say, oh, for that question, the answer is D, because I'm going to switch the answers around a little bit. All right? You still have to know what the correct answer is and why. Okay, and there are resources on the web for this book that have multiple choice, true, false, matching. All right, so there's another 100 questions or so that you can review per chapter for the test. And I lift those questions off the web and put them on the test as well. So a lot of the questions that are on the test you should be familiar with because of repetition. You've seen them already and you've worked with the information. Okay? Okay. The grade scale is just 90, 80, 70. When I have 55 right here, that's interesting. Okay, usually it's 60. That hasn't caused a problem. It could cause a problem because there are times when people actually want to fail this class, and which means sometimes they actually have to work hard to fail it, because if they get a 56, they don't fail it. They get a D. So, because if you fail a class, you get to take it over, and that F, I think, is erased from your permanent record. All right, so, but try to stay away from this area altogether. academic honesty, no fooling around, goofing around during tests and quizzes in lab or in lecture right here. I'll have to discipline somebody severely if you try to copy information from your textbook or notes or from somebody else's paper. All the tests are closed book, closed notes, no looking around the room. Okay, individual effort. Unless I come up with some kind of group assignment or something, but I don't foresee that happening. Okay, don't falsify any of the abilities that you have or the preparation that you have for a test. All this other stuff, I think you can read pretty easily. The important things here, these are all real important things. The only thing I specifically wanted to mention was the recording of lectures, right? If that's an issue for you, make sure you let me know this week in writing. Okay. A lot of students taking these higher level classes, of course, are going on to other professional programs, maybe a nursing program or a physician's assistant program or something. You need recommendations from your teachers. I'm real happy to do that, but you've got to help me write a good recommendation for you. So when you ask me for a recommendation, of course, put on a piece of paper and an email what your name is, your ID number, so I know how to correlate that. And if it has been a couple semesters or a year or two, it would be really nice for me to have a picture of you so I can recall who you are. If you give me a phone call and I hear your voice, I'll probably remember who you are, but if you send me an email, I may or may not really recall just by your name, okay? Or if you stop in and see me, then of course I'll remember who you are. But if it's just an email, give me a chance. Show me a picture of yourself. You got to tell me the course number, the CRN number of the class, and the year that you took it in the semester, and whether it was a lecture or lab class or both, okay? And then probably the most important thing, when you tell me you need a recommendation, you got to tell me what the deadline is. Right? So don't say, hey, I need a recommendation, and not tell me what the deadline is, and then show up the next day and say, hey, where's my recommendation? Okay? What is the professional lead time that you should give somebody when you ask them for a recommendation? 2 weeks, that's right. Always give somebody 2 weeks, and they'll probably do a good job for you. If it's overnight, okay, that's tough. And then also tell me how I submit it, if I put it in the mail, or if it's an online, or if you're going to pick it up. All right, so try not to lose this information. This might be really handy for you a little bit later. And here is the schedule. So today's the 13th, yep. All right, so here's our first session. We're going to just do the introduction to the class, talk a little bit about homeostasis. That's chapter one. Next time, we're going to start talking about chemistry. Notice we got three lectures on chemistry in here, so that's very important in this class. These are some very basic principles on how our body operates. And once you learn these principles, a lot of things just automatically fall in place. You don't have to know something about your body. Just by understanding basic chemical principles, you understand how things operate inside your body. So these are real important. All right, your first test is going to be on February 10th. I'd actually like to have it on the fourth week, but you can see I got a couple asterisks right here. That means that I don't want to hold a test this week because... What does it say? Anybody? There's going to be a disaster drill. I don't know if you should be privy to that information or not. It's supposed to be secret. No one knows when it's going to be. It should be during that week sometime. And I don't want you taking a test and then right in the middle of the test we have to evacuate the building. All right. So that makes the test a little inconvenient time. It's a little awkward to give a test on the fifth week right here, but that's just what we're going to do this semester. Okay. Well, maybe I'll be delayed getting through some of this information, and it might be good that we have it on the 10th instead of the 3rd. But anyway, this schedule is what? Tentative. It's going to change depending on what kind of questions you ask me, how fast I talk, all that kind of stuff. If the audio-visual equipment breaks and I can't give a lecture, who knows, right? Or if they decide to have 3 weeks of disaster drills. I don't know what might happen, right? So this is just a tentative... I see a mistake. Look, this 13, this 10 should be here, this 11 should be here, this 12 should be here, and this spring break week shouldn't have a number with it. Oh well, that's okay. All right, but this is spring break. It's really the first whole week in April. We don't count the class that week, right? Okay, the last test, the final test, is during finals week, but it's not a cumulative test completely. It should cover mostly just the last chapters that we covered. All right, and then this last bit right here, this is the schedule for your labs. Okay, so probably next time I'll have a hard copy to pass out, but you can go to the internet anytime you want. That's really something that you should see me during my office hours today. Unfortunately, I don't have office hours right after this class because I have another class in this room right afterwards. But after that class, if you want help logging into Blackboard, working your student number and your password just to make sure you have access to Blackboard, see me during my office hours today, and I can change your password if it's not working or show you how to use any of the internet resources. Okay? Okay, or you can email me and we can set up another time. All right, so that's the syllabus. There's something else I want you to work with, maybe not so much with me in class, maybe your lab instructor. I don't see it right here. So, I don't see it. What does that mean? We can go get it. Right click, save target as. Okay, this looks good. That file looks good. Is it right there? Right here? Good. Yeah. We'll save it. Well, I didn't see it. But that's okay. Did you see it? Oh, here it is. It was there. Okay. These computers. Okay. All right. So this is what I call a weekly study plan. Well, you've been through Bio 231, so you know how you have to apply yourself to get through one of these more advanced classes. All right. So you have to put time in outside of class. But how much time is it that you have to put into studying outside of class? All right, so for every hour in class, you should spend 3 hours per week, okay, outside of class studying. So this is, what, a four-hour class, well, plus a couple extra hours for lab. So initially, you should plan on studying outside of class 18 hours to really excel if you want an A in this class. Who wants an A in this class? Probably everybody would like an A in this class, right? Because not only does that help you get into professional programs, getting an A, but the information that you learn is all important in how you're going to live your professional life. So it's important information, right? So not just getting into a program, but how well you will do once you get into that program and then in life afterwards. All right, so I have two tables in this diagram right here. This one is a proposed study schedule, and then this one is the actual one. And I put in some numbers right here in terms of hours where somebody might be able to study. And so let's just say on Sunday morning I can actually study for about an hour and a half. All right? And then over here maybe Sunday night I can study for another hour and a half. Well, that's great because then every time you study on Sunday that amounts to 3 hours. That's a lot of time. Maybe you can get more. So on this table right here, sit down and figure out what you have to do on each of these days and where you can spend time studying. So this is just a plan, right? And it might relate very well to what you can do and sometimes maybe not. And then during the course of the week on this table here, actually keep a note to yourself on when you do study and then compare the two. And you might say, well, gee whiz, I didn't think I could study any on Monday at all, but it looks like I can study for 3 hours on Monday. And on Friday, my work schedule changed and I can't study at all on Friday, right? So keep your actual study record over here. Compare the two, and then look at your first grade on the first test and see how you're doing. All right, but you should show me or your lab instructor if you're uncomfortable doing that. I suppose you don't have to show me, but certainly don't falsify it for yourself. Write your accurate hours down here so that you're not kidding yourself. Okay, keep a real accurate. If you want to make a couple of these tables and show me one and keep an accurate one for yourself, that's fine, but keep at least a good accurate one for yourself. All right, and so if you get an A-plus on the first exam and you studied 18 hours, well, that means, well, maybe you could study 16 hours, okay, and still get an A on the test. But that will just give you some feedback as to how much you should be studying for this class. All right, so what's your impression of this 18 hours per week? Is that a lot or not a lot? That's a lot. I think everybody should kind of be amazed that that's a lot of time. Okay. All right, so I want to be upfront with everybody just with the standard approach to how you can get through a typical college-level class. All right, that's the amount of hours that you should be studying. Okay. And if it's a hard class compared to your background, then that number's got to be increased a little bit. And if it's an easy class compared to your background, maybe you're a chemistry major, all right, maybe you can decrease that number a little bit. All right. Okay, but keep some information. All right, so why is that important? Because success is not an accident, right? It just doesn't happen automatically. It's important to have some kind of plan in your life. A lot of people think that if they don't have a plan, they don't have a plan. Now, that sounds kind of silly. But if you don't have a plan, you really do have a plan that's operating in your life. And that is a plan for failure, right? So a failure to plan is really a plan to fail. If you don't have a plan, okay, you're almost assured failure. So try to develop a plan. You need a plan to get through this class. And this is just one little technique to help you get through that. Okay. So that's on the internet, and you can download these every week. And try to give me some feedback. Okay, no one last semester ever gave me any feedback for me to know for sure if that's a good number. Okay, but let me know. I would guess most of you are going to say, yeah, that number's about right. Okay, even though I give you study guides and really cue you into what you should be studying. All right, and I think the reason why that is, and we might understand this during the course because this is a physiology course, when you learn new information, your brain actually has to change. It has to rebuild itself. Right? So for instance, you decided to start lifting weights and you want to start doing some curls to build up, what muscle is that? And what's a synergistic muscle in there besides the biceps brachii? No, that's antagonistic. The brachialis, yeah, the biceps brachii and the brachialis are synergistic. They're working together to make forearm flexion happen. All right, so what happens when you start using that muscle? What happens? Is that muscle the same the day afterwards? No. And what about in a week or 2 weeks? What happens to that big muscle or that muscle? It starts to look like this one. It gets really big and strong, right? Okay, so muscles change, right? They learn when you stress them. And as a matter of fact, maybe from anatomy you learn that bones change all the time too. I think bones completely switch out every 6 years. And when you exercise a bone, what happens to a bone? It grows and gets stronger too. Helps protect you from what disease? Osteoporosis, right? Okay, so whenever you work a part of your body, it modifies its structure. And one of the things that we're going to learn in here is that there's always a relationship between the structure of something and the function that it has. Right, so when you start to work with your brain and learn new things, languages and music and mathematics are particularly good at this. Right, the structure of your brain actually changes and it makes learning easier. And in this class, the structure of your brain really does change, right, when you start to apply yourself to learn this information. So toward the end of an anatomy class or the end of a physiology class, it actually sometimes gets a little bit easier because, why? Your brain is changing and you're learning how to learn that information. Okay, but in order to force your brain to change, you gotta apply yourself. And that's where this time comes in right here. So probably these hours at the end of the class don't have to be as much as at the beginning of the class. But by the end of the class, you might enjoy studying so much that you might even study more, okay? Because your brain will just like that information. Okay, so that's the study plan for you. Okay, does anybody have any questions at all? Yeah. That's called ARIS. Let's see if I have it on the syllabus. That is on almost every page of the textbook. So let me see, did I have that in the syllabus? Let's go back up to all the way to the textbook. Oh, I don't have it here. Okay, maybe I'll modify the syllabus and put it back on Blackboard, but it's on almost every page in your textbook. It's mhhe.aris.com. And you don't need a password. It asks for a password, but that's only if an instructor sets up a class on the publisher's website. If you go to the top of the page, I don't have it in my favorite section. If you go to the top of a page and click resources, you'll get to all the student resources without entering a password. So I don't want to show you all the details of the class the first time because I couldn't talk about anything important like homeostasis. So every day we'll talk a little bit about how to find all of this information for you. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'll put the first couple of grades in there. When you go to Blackboard, you only see your grade, and sometimes I find it helpful if students can see everybody's grade to see where they rank in the class and the distribution, et cetera, et cetera. So Blackboard doesn't work for that, so I make a spreadsheet up and maybe turn it into a PDF file, and I'll put that as a PDF file into Blackboard or my website, and I'll even post it here. Okay, now when you post grades where you can see everybody's grade, you can't use their student number. So I don't have it listed by your student number. I'll just have it by the rank by what you got on the first test and second test. And then so you have to know what grade you have on the first and second test. So you go down the first column to find your grade on the first test, down the second column to find your grade on the second test, and then you know what row is yours from then on out. So on Blackboard, I'll probably put your first two grades so you know what they are, and then you can find it on the big spreadsheet. Okay? Okay. So it won't be by anybody's name or number or nothing. I can't even give random numbers. It's kind of interesting. A lot of confidentiality is important. Yeah.
We have to have a picture student ID card.
Oh, okay. That's a good question. I didn't mention that specifically. Cypress College picture identification card. I will take a driver's license. Okay, but you know, if you ever want to check something out of the library or take a makeup test or something at the library or other kinds of services at Cypress, you have to have a Cypress College picture ID, which I think is $2 and maybe about 10 minutes. Yeah? Is it a picture of you on there? Yeah, that will work for the test, but it won't work for the library here. Okay, one place in the library where I think it won't work is the testing center. Okay, so there might be some places in the library it doesn't work. Okay. Now, the reason why I do that, the kind of a legal issue for me, because I teach a lot of online classes, and of course, when I have students take an online test on campus, I have no idea who they are. So I ask that you have to provide a Cypress College picture ID. And since I require one of my classes to go through the hoops, what does that mean? I got to ask everybody to do the same thing because I can't be prejudicial to one class. All right, so everybody should show me a picture ID. I just treat everybody the same way, no matter what class it is. Okay. Okay. All right, so I can go over this information again next time or after class or whatever. All right, so let's sort of get started with lecture. Where the heck would lecture be? Here's Blackboard. How about under course documents? Lecture PowerPoint slides, and the only one that I've reworked is lecture number one, but I think I've downloaded this one already. Now, this has pictures from your textbook, and of course, all the pictures in your textbook are copyrighted. You can't download these and print them out and sell them to anybody without telling the publisher that you're going to do that, and they'll say, don't do it. All right, so I just put this on Blackboard because Blackboard is a password-protected site. So if those pictures get out, we know somebody is violating the rights of McGraw-Hill. So this is only for your own use, right? And the study guides as well. All right, so where do we have the PowerPoint slides? I think this is it right here. Okay. All right, so here's the first lecture. Let me just write down on the board where we are. We started at what? 11:30, and so we go to 12:50. Okay, great. Oh, okay, not much time, but that's okay. All right, so the first thing is, this is a physiology class. Of course, you have to know anatomy, and you should probably know the definition of anatomy. Anatomy is the scientific study of what about the human body? The structure. Anatomy is the structure. Yeah, the structure of the human body. Physiology is the scientific study of the function of the human body. So they're two totally different things, but they are related to each other. There are always structural, functional relationships. For instance, what can you tell me about your hand, the special structure of your hand that allows you to communicate, take notes, that maybe a cat or a dog couldn't do? Yeah, you have an opposable thumb. So a cat and a dog, maybe dogs have 5 digits in the front, but cats, I think, only have 4 digits, right? But they don't have this opposable thumb, right? So they can't grab something. So they can't take notes, right? So that's a form of written language. That's a fairly high-level function, right? That's a physiologic function, communication. And that form of communication is only possible if you have that particular kind of structure. And so what happens to function if we change the structure? What happens if somebody gets a thumb cut off by accident? All right, yeah, it's really difficult to write, for instance. Or I don't know what kind of sign languages use the thumb, probably a lot, hitchhiking or whatever. That function is disturbed, right? So there is a functional structural relationship always. So, but what we're going to focus on in this class is we understand anatomy. We're going to now overlay function on top of that understanding. Okay, so the other thing to appreciate is when you change structure, you change the function of something. They're related. And when you change the structure of something and the function changes, that might be beneficial or it might be harmful. So if the function of something changes into the harmful realm, now we call that pathophysiology, right? That's the study of how physiological processes are altered in a disease or injurious state. So from here, you could probably assume if there's pathophysiology, what can you tell me about the anatomy? Oh, I don't have anatomy on here. What can you tell me about the anatomy? Somewhere in that organism, the anatomy has changed, and the anatomy could be maybe a gross structure, right, like a thumb. It could be a microscopic structure, like an organelle, or it could be even a chemical structure. Maybe an enzyme changes shape somehow because of some mutation in DNA, right? So we can always relate pathophysiology back to some change in structure as well. And in this class, we get to understand how these changes take place. Okay. Okay, I want to talk just a little bit about scientific method and the uses for scientific method. Here are some steps where you accomplish the scientific method. First, you form what we call a testable hypothesis about some observations that you're making. So a hypothesis is just an educated guess about some aspect of the natural world and how it functions. And I had a really good example this morning of a hypothesis. But it's something that's not proven. It's just really a guess based on your observations, your initial observations about something. Okay? And then, of course, that hypothesis... Oh, let me work with my cursor right here. Hold on a second. Okay? That hypothesis has to be testable. That means that in the real world, you have to be able to prove it or disprove it. It can't be in some spiritual realm. It can't be related to faith because that's outside the realm of scientific endeavor. Okay? And once you have a hypothesis, then we can come up with experiments and conduct those experiments and analyze the experiments to test the hypothesis to see if whether the hypothesis holds true or not. Right? And after we analyze the experiments, we can draw conclusions about whether or not the results support the hypothesis or don't support the hypothesis. Okay? And then after the hypothesis has support from scientific experiments, it can evolve into a theory. Right? So a theory is a general statement explaining some natural phenomena that's based on a proven hypothesis. All right, so a hypothesis is something that's not proven by experiments. So these terms are used inappropriately in our everyday language quite a bit because a lot of times you might be walking down the sidewalk or having dinner with somebody and they say, oh, well, I have a theory about how something happens. Okay, but what does a theory mean? Okay, theory means that someone has gone through the trouble to develop an experiment, right, and conducted the experiments, analyzed the results, and then compared the results to what they were thinking to begin with, right? So a theory, right, is a very sophisticated set of understandings about how the world really works, but a hypothesis is just a guess on how something works, right? So in most cases, when somebody says, oh, I have a theory about how something works, what should they really be saying? I have a hypothesis. And guess why we don't say, oh, I have a hypothesis about that? Because it's this big, long word, it's hard to pronounce, right? All right, so we just usually say we have a theory, but a theory is really a sophisticated idea that's backed up by a lot of effort. And we're going to talk about that effort just a little bit more. Okay, so if someone walks up to you, two people walk up to you, and one of them says, I have a hypothesis on how you can make $1 million a year, and another person walks up to you almost the same time and says, I have a theory on how you can make $1 million a year doing something, which person are you going to listen to?
Theory.
The theory, because that person has a lot of evidence backing them up. The person with the hypothesis is just making a guess as to how something is working, right? So a theory is much more important in how we should live our lives than a hypothesis. And the big reason why I mention that is because you're going to find a lot of information in your book, and all the information in your book has been proven to the theory level. It's not a hypothesis. So all the information, even though as strange as it may sound to you, has a lot of scientific evidence that is backing it up, and it is generally accepted by the scientific community and medical community. Right, so that's really the importance of the book. It's not just giving you guesswork, it's telling you reliable information that you can count on. Okay, so how do we test a hypothesis? Well, we usually design an experiment that includes two different groups. There is an experimental group and a control group. And both of those groups undergo experimentation, but one group gets, let's just talk, maybe it's a drug trial. Maybe we want to give estrogen to somebody for some particular reason. Maybe we want to maintain their bone health, or maybe we want to help them through pregnancy, or who knows, there might be a whole number of different reasons. And estrogen is kind of an interesting compound because it's a lipid. And does anybody know anything about lipids as opposed to aqueous compounds? Okay. Okay, for instance, butter is a lipid, and if you're buttering a piece of toast in the morning and you drop it on your pants, can you just get a wet paper towel and clean up that butter off your pants? No, because water and butter don't mix, right? In order for butter to dissolve away, you have to dissolve it in another lipid or some kind of special solvent, like a detergent that can dissolve in water and an oil at the same time. All right, so a lipid is what we call hydrophobic, won't dissolve in water. So when you want to give somebody an estrogen shot, can you give them an estrogen shot with the vehicle or the substance that estrogen is dissolved in? Can it be water? No, it can't be water. It has to be, and what does it have to be? It has to be another lipid. It has to be an oil. It has to be a liquid oil, right, at room temperature, that estrogen can dissolve in. So we give that shot to somebody, that estrogen shot, but it has oil in it. Okay, so if we're testing the effects of estrogen, you might be thinking, oh, well, when we give somebody a shot of estrogen, they get oil as well. Does oil have any physiologic consequences? Does it perform any functions in the body? And guess what? Oil by itself has estrogenic properties. Okay, so when you give somebody a shot of estrogen and oil, and you measure, how do you know if what you're seeing is due to the oil, the vehicle that estrogen's dissolved in, or the estrogen? You don't really know, right? So that's why we have the experimental group that gets the shot, oil, and estrogen, and there is a control group that gets a shot, and that shot gets the same volume, gets the same needle, and it gets the oil, the same oil that was given to the other person, but no estrogen. Gets everything minus the estrogen. We call that a control group. And those people are going to respond differently than people that don't get any shot at all. And now we can compare those two real effects. What is the effect of the oil? What is the effect with estrogen? And what we're really interested in is what the effect of that estrogen. So we always have to have an experimental group and a control group, because no matter what we do to somebody, that's going to affect their physiology one way or the other. We use quantitative measurements to, and they're performed blindly. So when we look at the effects of that estrogen shot, we want to use some kind of instrumentation that is unbiased. It's going to make a reliable measurement on every individual, no matter who they are or where they are in the world. And they should be performed blindly. Well, what does that mean? That just means that, for instance, the people that are analyzing the data, the people that are giving the shot, the people that are mixing up the drugs, they should not know anything about the patients or what the materials are that they're working with. So when somebody administers a shot, they should know if it's a shot with estrogen or if it's a shot with just oil, because every time you interact with somebody, right, you convey information on how you interact with them. And we found when people do experiments, if they know ahead of time, people will have a tendency to influence patients for a beneficial outcome, and that helps give the results that you want. Okay, so people doing the test should not know exactly what they're doing. And then we'd like to analyze the data again with unbiased methods, which we call statistics. Right, so the data will be analyzed mathematically and impartially to look at the results. Okay, so I talked a lot about the scientific method, but it's important to know why we go through all of this trouble. Why do we start with an experimental group and a control group? What's the purpose of the scientific method? What are we trying to get at? And to prove a hypothesis, you have to prove a hypothesis to come up with a theory. And what is that theory again? The theory provides you with, who do you want to listen to? Somebody with a hypothesis or a theory? A theory, right? Because somebody that, or a group of people that have a theory, that is what we call reliable information. So the purpose of the scientific method is to provide humanity with reliable information. And information that's not reliable, you should what? You just should forget about, right? And not be fooled by it. So scientific method, when you go through all these unbiased methods, this very nice methodological approach to getting acquiring information, it should give you reliable information. That's the purpose of the scientific method. All right, so a lot of times we use scientific method to develop the application of new drugs. So when a new drug is suggested by experiments, its effectiveness and toxicity, so we want to see if it's effective and what some of the side effects might be, especially if they're deleterious effects or harmful effects. First, it's tested in things that can't be hurt, living systems like tissue culture. Okay, and then if the results suggest that it's going to support the hypothesis, then that treatment is applied to animal models, like rats and mice, maybe dogs or cats, right? And a lot of people have ethical questions with regard to that, animal testing, but a lot of times we find that many of the drugs are toxic, right? And so we wouldn't want to give that to a human. So animal studies are very important for that reason. Okay, but first, before that, we do what? We do tissue culture studies. All right, and then if it still looks good, then we perform experiments with people. And the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, has set up these different kinds of trials to prove the effectiveness of various drugs. Phase 1 trials study the toxicity and the metabolism in healthy volunteers. Okay, so we're going to, in this class, study normal physiology in normal people. And maybe some of you have worked in a hospital. There's one cardiovascular test that's very easy to perform on somebody, and that is to get your heart rate. How easy is it to get your heart rate? How would you measure your own heart rate or somebody else's heart rate? What's an easy way? Yeah, measure a pulse. Like, where would you measure a pulse? Some guys are pretty sophisticated. But the easiest way is, okay, the radial artery, right? Right by your radius bone right here. It's very superficial, and it beats, and you can count 1, 2, 3, 4. On a normal individual, that's very easy. But what happens if somebody's a diabetic? What happens if somebody is obese? Or what happens if somebody has some kind of cardiovascular disease? You go to find a pulse right there, and what do you have? You got nothing. Okay, so when you start to study people that have a disease process in them, it becomes very difficult to measure very simple things like maybe ECG or glucose in their body, or any kind of measurement becomes more difficult when somebody is sick. So before we even start testing drugs on people, we don't look at a disease population, we just look at normal people to see what the difficulties are. Because as soon as you go to the disease population, everything changes, and changes in ways you maybe can't appreciate, right, before you start to do it. All right, so then if it works, then effectiveness and toxicity is tested in a target population. Oh, I forgot something. Well, somebody has peripheral vascular disease, how can you still get their pulse really easy? Carotid artery. Okay, or maybe a pedal pulse or something like that. They're different places, right? But that just kind of underscores the fact that disease processes alter things in people, and we're interested in helping people with diseases here, okay? And then after the phase 2 trials, the phase 3 trials, we have a widespread testing of the drug in a diverse population. So it's a very careful stepwise process through various populations, always looking for effectiveness and toxicity because we don't want to hurt anybody, like kill their heart or wipe out their valves in their heart or something like that. And then lastly, the drug is tested for other potential uses. And as a matter of fact, if it's an FDA-approved drug, the history of that drug and the side effects of that drug are recorded and monitored for the whole life of that drug whenever it's administered to a patient, right? So in perpetuity. So if there is a side effect that develops after 5 or 10 years, right, that can be traced, and then the drug is taken off the market. And that's something that does not happen, for instance, with a food supplement that you buy. There are many good food supplements that you buy, but they're not regulated by the FDA. And all those food supplements don't go through any of these trials. The data is not recorded. We have no idea if they really work or not. And if there is a problem, no one is ever told about it. All right, so that's just a really big difference between FDA-approved drugs and other drugs that you might take from over-the-counter. All right, so FDA, I'll just say one last thing about FDA. FDA is approached by Western medicine to understand medication to help people. But there are other systems of medicine, right, like traditional Oriental medicine, Chinese, for instance. And they don't have an FDA approval process, but some of those therapies are very effective because what's backing up some of these treatments, these herbal treatments? Thousands of years of experience, right? So not in a traditional Western medical way of thinking, but in a Eastern or Oriental or Asian way of thinking. So, but if you want to treat yourself with any of those herbal medications, would you want to go to somebody with Western medicine training, like an MD? No, I wouldn't read something in a newspaper and try it. I would go talk to a physician that's been trained in traditional Oriental medicine. All right, to take advantage of those thousands of years of experience. So that's real important. So there are two important tracks there for you to consider. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about homeostasis. Homeostasis just means staying the same. And I worked up some lecture slides, and that might have been modified some by your lab instructors, that go in a little bit more detail. Your book does an okay job with homeostasis, but I provide other good figures that you'll get in lab that cover homeostasis, but I want to introduce it to you here in lecture. And what can you tell me about things inside you compared to the outside world? And let's just start maybe with temperature. Are you the same as the room temperature, or are you different?
Higher.
Yeah, you're higher. You're different, and you're a lot higher than the room temperature. I don't know what the room temperature is. It's 75 or something in here. And what is your body temperature? 98.7, 98.6, somewhere in there. Okay, and if you go into a hot room or a cold room, what is your body temperature? It stays the same. Okay, because that temperature maintains the living processes in your body. If it deviates from that temperature, then we call that a disease process. And if it deviates a lot, that could be lethal. If it goes too high, it could be lethal. That's hyperthermia. If it deviates too low, that's hypothermia. Both cases are fatal. Okay, so homeostasis is a way of thinking about your body, how it maintains the internal environment in a way that's suitable to support life. not just in terms of temperature, but in terms of all physiologic parameters, like blood pressure. What happens to a person if their blood pressure goes too high? Is that good or bad? Well, blood is going to flow a lot faster, but it's bad because a blood vessel can pop open, right, and all the blood flow out of your body or something. That's terrible. Oh, that happened to somebody, not because of blood pressure, but because they had a defect. Who's that actor last year? His aorta dissected, burst open. John Ritter, yeah, okay. Maybe high blood pressure had some effect on that. Okay, so blood pressure, temperature, glucose levels in your blood, salt levels in your blood are very important. They're regulated. What else do I have in here? Yeah, the pH. Does anybody know what pH is? What is a pH? It's a measure of something. It's a measure of acidity in your body. And we're going to really understand more about pH when we start talking about chemistry. But it's a measure of acidity or alkalinity or the basic nature of your body. It doesn't change. It changes less than your body temperature. Anybody know what the pH of your body is or your blood? 7.35. Okay, it's a little bit alkaline. Absolutely neutral is pH 7. It's a little bit basic. All right, and if your pH were to change, tell me if this sounds like a big change. 7.35 to 7.25. Does that sound like a big change?
No.
By numbers, it doesn't. But you know what? Probably would kill you. If your pH were to change, say, in a couple of minutes from 3.5 to 2.5. People's pHs can drift over a long period of time. They can adjust a little bit. But pH is regulated very tightly in your body. Okay, to maintain homeostasis. So homeostasis is a condition in which blood pressure and all these other physiologic factors or parameters of your internal environment inside your body are maintained within a range of values suitable to support life. And this is kind of an advanced concept because it's a dynamic state where all the body systems are working and constantly adjusting to changing internal and external conditions. So homeostasis doesn't mean that your body temperature stays exactly at one temperature your whole life, or that your blood pressure stays exactly at one pressure your whole life, or your blood glucose level at one concentration your whole life. What homeostasis means is that all these parameters can change a little bit, okay? But they don't change very much. They can only change in small amounts to support the living processes inside your body. So when I think of homeostasis, I really think of homeostasis as being a dance where your temperature goes up and down. Your pH maybe goes up and down a little bit. Your pressure goes up and down. Your water balance changes a little bit. But all these parameters are changing in such a way that no parameter changes a lot, because if one parameter changes a lot, then you're into a disease state which might be fatal. So homeostasis, think of homeostasis more as a dance. Okay? So let me talk a little bit more. I'll talk some more about homeostasis after a couple more slides. Okay. That's just a little introduction. So homeostasis is maintained via regulation in your body. And your body regulates various processes by using signaling molecules, signaling compounds, or signaling systems like through the nervous system. So let's talk about some of these signaling compounds or signaling molecules. Some molecules are used for long-range reflexes. So for instance, here's a cell that's going to secrete a hormone. This cell right here is a glandular cell. It produces a chemical compound that it secretes from itself, secretes it into the interstitial space, and from the interstitial space, it diffuses into the blood. And once this compound, the product from this gland cell, enters the blood, where does it go? Once that hormone is in the blood, where does it go? It goes everywhere that the blood goes. It goes all over your body, where it can signal target cells to change their physiology, to change their response. All right, so this cell right here can affect what? Every cell in your body, depending on where the blood is going. So this is a very long-range reflex. And so what kind of gland secretes a hormone? Okay, yeah, I don't know why anybody would know that before taking this class, but this is true. right? A hormone is secreted by an endocrine gland. Not any kind of glandular cell, but an endocrine gland secretes a hormone. And the definition of an endocrine gland is that it synthesizes and secretes a chemical that is distributed by the blood, and it's carried everywhere in the blood. Okay, so that's what an endocrine gland is. Other cells secrete signaling molecules like this neuron right here. This neuron, could you tell that was a neuron? Okay, what are these little jobbers right here? Those are dendrites. Here's an axon. Right, very good. Okay, so this neuron, when it is stimulated electrically, when that electrical signal gets down to the end of this axon, it's going to release a neurotransmitter. All right, so a neuron doesn't necessarily release a hormone, it releases a neurotransmitter. And in most neurotransmitters, it just diffuses to a neighboring cell and it affects the metabolism or electrical state of a neighboring cell. And so that's how the two cells can communicate. Now, this is kind of a short range. This is just by neighboring cells. But there are circumstances where we have another kind of cell like this. What is this kind of cell again? It's a neuron. When it is stimulated electrically, it releases a signaling molecule, and that signaling molecule is now picked up by the cardiovascular system and distributed all over the body. So this particular product or chemical, would you want to call it a hormone because it gets picked up by the blood, or would you like to call it a neurotransmitter because it's released by a nerve cell? Terminology is a little confusing and it breaks down, and the best way to consider this compound right here is what? It has components of both a hormone and a neurotransmitter, so we call it a neurohormone, okay? And a neurohormone has long-range effects in the body because it's distributed by the blood, okay? Okay, so that's the importance of this slide. And I'll stop after I talk about this slide a little bit. As opposed to short-range control, we call this local control. Local control means when cells control metabolism just in their neighboring cells. This local cell might secrete a signaling molecule that affects a neighboring target cell. We call that product a paracrine agent. Right? When a cell releases a signaling molecule and it goes back and it binds to and affects the metabolism of the cell that secreted it, we call that an autocrine. So a paracrine and an autocrine are important in local control. A paracrine affects neighboring cells. An autocrine agent will affect what? The cell that secretes it. Okay? And so these are what we call local control signals. Okay? And so next time, all right, I'll finish up with homeostasis and move on to the next chapter. Now, if you're having trouble with Blackboard, see me after my next class and I can help you log in. Okay?